Today's episode is brought to you by our friends over at Virgil Films. With over 25 years of distribution experience, Virgil has released such hits as Super Size Me and the Oscar-nominated Restrepo, along with a trove of indie treasures like Forks Over Knives, To Die For, 7 Yards, and Speed is Expensive. Now, you can find all of those films, along with the entire Virgil catalog, on any transactional platform out there, like Amazon, Apple TV, YouTube, Tubi, and the rest. Are you a filmmaker and you're having trouble with distribution? Talk to Virgil. They work with every major platform directly, and they offer a variety of deals that fit with every filmmaker's needs, from standard distribution to service deals. They do it all. And they don't just distribute films, they elevate them. Truthfully, they're just really good people to work with. So if you want to learn more, head on over to virgilfilms.com and tell them Christian Taylor sent you. And now, on with the show. Hi, everybody. Welcome to Documentary First, an inside look at documentary filmmaking. I'm your host, Christian Taylor, and a documentary filmmaker myself. This is the podcast where we sit down with documentary filmmakers and we talk to them about real life stories, where they're capturing these stories one frame at a time so we can all become better storytellers. Today, I'm super excited to have a new emerging filmmaker with us. Her name is Quinlan Bates. That is not her name. Her name is Quinlan Benson Yates. He loved how I like put your name together. Anyway, Quinn, we are so happy to have you with us. I promise I will try to get your name right from here on out.
And don't be surprised, that is not the first time I've heard that
really?
Spelling of my name. Yeah, not at all. This is probably the fifth time. So you're not alone. Don't worry.
Oh, that's so good.
Yeah,
I'm glad.
Really happy to see you. Thanks for having me.
All right. Well, we're here to talk about your film, Epicville. This is quite an interesting film. I was delighted to watch it today. I saw a lot of parallels between my own life. So there's a lot of lessons to be learned here, I think, personally. But I also saw a lot of lessons that we can learn sort of in our filmmaking industry. I sort of see this as something that we can learn, during this, while everything is changing in our filmmaking industry. So before we dive into all of that, I do want to give your bio and let you talk a little bit about who you are. So Quinn is an award-winning filmmaker with over a decade of experience. Now, what's interesting about her experience that we'll get into is she made this film before she went to film school, which is pretty cool. Her feature documentary, Epicville, now available on Amazon and Apple TV, gained nationwide distribution through PBS with promotions on CNN and SiriusXM. Quinn was the head writer and producer for the series Top Voices, where she produced and co-wrote the pilot and completed production for the first season. She's a 2-time winner of the Santa Barbara International Film Festival's 10-10-10 filmmaking competition, and her first winning film, Miss Rivers, screened at the festival, including the Palm Springs LGBTQ Film Festival, and it was distributed on the global streaming platform Reverie. Quinn earned her MFA in film and television production from the prestigious USC School of Cinematic Arts. She is a Town and Gown Scholar and a recipient of the James Bridges Endowed Scholarship and the Hobson Lucas Family Foundation Endowment. She graduated from the University of California, Santa Barbara with honors in psychology, a distinction in film and media studies, and the Film and Media Studies Department Outstanding Graduation Senior Award. Her most recent short film, A Western Comedy Man, which sounds quite interesting, recently premiered at the Austin Film Festival. That is a lot of honors, young lady. That's impressive, quite impressive. So I am looking forward to learning more about you. So tell me, you must be a smart cookie to garner all of those awards.
I counted that this past year was my 10th year from the very first time I walked onto a film set in undergrad. That was my very first time. And if you just keep working step by step, which is a message that Bill is very familiar with, you can climb some mountains.
That's very true. Did you grow up wanting to be a filmmaker, or did you just kind of happen upon a film set and decide, this looks fun?
filmmaking, I needed an invitation into that world. For me, growing up, it never felt like a thing that I could do or people around me were doing. And I think that what I had to find was people that it was for filmmaking to feel accessible to me. I think the first time it did feel accessible was when I was at UC Santa Barbara for my undergrad. And I met my friend Nick Hornung, and he was like, "Hey, we're looking for a script supervisor on a film shoot that's happening next week. Are you interested?" And I was like, "Wow, yes, I'm totally interested." And that kind of just started my filmmaking career. But when I was younger, I didn't necessarily have a camera. I didn't necessarily have, you know, I wasn't making YouTube videos. I was actually a 8-year-old lead rock star punk singer in a band with my dad, but I wasn't like making film. So the artistic urge was there. But yeah, I definitely had to be invited into a filmmaking space.
Well, what I love about that story is that you participated in the classic improv game of yes and, which is, and soon as somebody, you know, offers you an idea, your first response is yes, and let me, you know, keep going. So that's pretty cool. It leads to all sorts of adventures. And now here you are. Pretty cool. That's just amazing. So now you have finished your first, you know, feature documentary. You've done a couple of shorts, and what are you doing at the moment?
Right now, I just finished producing a few different short films through USC, and I just graduated in May 2025, and I'm doing the wonderful job searching hunt while finishing development on my first narrative feature script, which is based on my past as a punk rocker. It's about a middle school girl who starts a punk band with her best friend and her dad. It's a lot about creative collaborations. So I'm working on that passion project as I'm, you know, coming up to filming someone else's short film and doing some documentary development with a professor at USC. So I'm keeping busy.
Yeah, that's great. Awesome. All right. Now this film, Epic Build, didn't, you know, it's not coming out. It has already released, like we said. It's on Amazon and Apple TV. When did it release? It in 2025, correct?
Yes. So it released in onto Apple TV and Amazon in 2025. It also released on PBS in 2024, right, in September. And then we first took it to festivals in 2022. So it's been a very long rollout. And as any filmmaker knows, distribution is its own beast, its own marathon. So, you know, we started production of this film in November 2018. And documentaries can be notoriously long. And I discovered that the very first time we met with Leslie Murphy about this film, it was actually going to be a short film. And it was me, Aaron Kessler, and Kyle Murphy in her office. We were like 23 years old. She was like, "Hey, you know, I have a brother who does a lot of extreme events. Would you be interested in making a short film about him?" And then, so we went out and filmed him training for the Arrowhead 135 race, which is a extreme endurance, 135-mile, billed as the foot race version of it, in northern Minnesota, which is the coldest place in the continental U.S., and we went out and we filmed with him in 2019, where, of course, the polar vortex hits. That's part of the film.
I remember that.
Temperatures are freezing. And, you know, we were figuring out a lot of things as we went along with this film. And then, you know, we filmed him in Arrowhead, and then we filmed him only like a few days later, really, going up Aconcagua, one of the tallest mountains in the Western Hemisphere, which is 22,000 feet in altitude. And we, you know, again, this was going to be a short film concept. And what made it into a feature film was Bill shipped us a hard drive that had like a decade's worth of archival footage of almost every race he'd ever done, started in 2008 to 2018, of course, when we were filming with him. And that opened up a whole conversation of, hey, we totally could make this into a feature film. So, you know, it's going back to that concept of like step by step, you know, you accomplish things a little at a time.
Yeah. Well, I just want people to understand, yes, it takes a long time for a lot of documentaries to come to fruition from, you know, ideas, as they germinate to, production and trying to figure out, or even development before that, you know, development, production, pre-production. You throw in there a polar vortex or a pandemic or, you know, funding and financing problems. And then you throw in there, you know, distribution things falling apart. So this, in my opinion, is not an old film. And we're not going to be talking about anything old. What I feel about this whole project that you've done gives us a survival blueprint, not only in life, but also in our film industry. And that's what I love about this film, is that it really gave me some good things to hold on to in my own personal life, but also as a filmmaker. One of the, there's several quotes that I wrote down here from Bill. One of the things that he said was, when you go after your dreams, it isn't easy. And you can see that over and over again with Bill. It wasn't easy. And there was not a lot of success in this film. It didn't, you know, it wasn't like he climbed K2 or Aconcagua. How do you say that? Aconcagua. And Aconcagua. There were lots of parties.
Yeah, we mispronounced that throughout the entire film.
Yeah. Aconcagua. And it started off, I mean, Bill lost everything when his video rental store collapsed. And it's sort of like today, you know, filmmakers are watching this streaming economy totally reset, you know, like growth has slowed down for films. The platforms are pushing their ad tiers and buyers are being so much more selective with what, you know, tiers they're going with. Ad, you know, based streaming is surging. And there's just a lot of new realities happening for filmmakers. And, you know, it's not as lucrative as it used to be. And there's just not a lot of opportunities for us as filmmakers. And so we're questioning our identity. We're questioning, is this even possible? We're questioning, you know, I mean, I don't know how many times I've just sat and think I'm a failure. And my identity as a filmmaker, you know, I mean, I just don't even know if that's who I am anymore. And so again, we'll, as we talk more, some of the things that Bill said just keep, you know, reverberating in my brain. One of them is that reinvention is not a moment, it's a system. So he didn't bounce back. He built a repeatable practice, which was showing up, enduring, and adapting. So talk to me about that, like what his process was.
Yeah. Bill has a lot of great catchphrases. One of them is show up and suffer. And I think in one of his early interviews, he says, you know, I have two talents. I show up and I suffer. And that, you know, it's fun to hear, but there's a really important truth to it. And something that I had to learn making the film, because when you're, you know, when you're told, hey, you're going to go and film an athlete at an event, of course you're showing up and you're just kind of hoping, and there's a sort of expectation there of like, yeah, we're going to show the suffering and then we're going to show the success and we're going to capture that. Mm-hmm. We're going to capture crossing the finish line. And that's what this story is going to be. And that was not at all what the story was. And I find that, you know, I found that pretty interesting that you were also going through a moment of like, you know, am I still a filmmaker? Is this what I want to do? And that's exactly what Bill went through when he started not crossing the finishing line. He had a lot of success in a lot of his races. He was completing the Badwater 135, which is a 135-mile foot race through Death Valley, the hottest place in the US that you could really do that in earlier versions.
But is that also when he was younger? I don't mean to interrupt, but I do want to give context. Was that when he was younger, and did he start failing when he got older, or was it a mixture of the two?
Another one of my favorite Bill's catchphrases is, I am always 30 years old. So in Bill's mind, he is always 30 years old. But the reality, like you just asked, is yes, he was getting older. And, you know, there's a certain point where he had to come to terms with that. And I think it's a beautiful thing to renegotiate your reality, even if it can be really, really hard and really tough. And so when Bill was younger, he was doing really well in the desert races. I think he also does really well in the heat compared to the cold. The cold has a lot more of like equipment management. It's like much more of an unsupported race. So there's a lot of other factors, but you did point out, you know, one of the key factors there. In Death Valley, he also had no like time checkpoints to like disqualify him for the race like he does in Arrowhead 135. And so Bill's amazing talent is his great mental fortitude, his ability to keep going and keep going. You know, if you give him endless time, he'll keep going. And so he did really well. He did a bad water, a double bad water, a quadruple bad water. He was the fourth oldest person ever to do that, and the oldest person ever to complete a quadruple bad water. And that was, you know, really, really wonderful success. And then he stopped finishing, at Arrowhead. He could not finish Arrowhead. And when I went to film with him, it was his, you know, we counted 7th and 8th and 9th attempt with him that we were filming. And he didn't realize that when we were first filming with him. And he later told me, yeah, when I saw that you made a map for me of how far I went every year, but the fact that I never finished every year, but the fact that I kept coming back and that this is my 8th attempt, and that in of itself is admirable. And so, you know, us filming with him at Arrowhead started that transition of perspective for him, which I didn't know about at the time, but you know, that was an interesting thing. And, you know, it's exactly kind of where you're at, where it's like you start questioning, you know, whether it's a identity thing or it's a, you know, can I have a new perspective on what I've been experiencing?
Yeah. And I think, you know, if we're applying that to filmmaking, which is what I said I wanted to do in the beginning, a couple of things I think could be true. It is important, I think, to recognize who we are and how we perform best. And I think oftentimes we feel like we need to be everything and do everything. So in the film industry, we've got to be a writer, a director, a producer. We've got to do all of that in order to be successful. And I think when you're starting out, we do need to learn all of those different disciplines. And I think we need to test those to see where we do succeed, where we enjoy doing things the most. And I think that is a key. What do we truly enjoy doing the most? And then where do we have the most success? You know, so Bill in the heat was having more success. And then he would distinguish himself in different ways in that environment. And then when he would try the cold things, he wasn't having as much success. So in a sense, had he learned from that more quickly and reinvented himself, he might have been able to have more time doing the things where he was having more success. That could be one lesson. Another lesson, you know, is exactly what he did learn, which is, you know, the reframing of perspective, which is, I am not a failure. I am showing up to try. And that in itself is success. But I do think at some point you need to apply that new perspective to other things and not keep beating your head, you know, against that same wall for sure.
But you know what's interesting?
Would you agree?
What's interesting with Bill though is that he had success, right? But success wasn't fulfilling necessarily. It validating, certainly, but not necessarily fulfilling for him. And so I would spend 7 hours at a time interviewing Bill because, you know, as an endurance athlete, he could go for 7 hours and we would talk a lot. But what was really interesting to me and what kept me so curious over the years of making this film was that Bill wanted to challenge himself. He still wants to challenge himself. And it wasn't, even when he was crossing the finish lines, that didn't signal to him, okay, this is what I'm good at, and I'll just get better at this one thing. It was, let me come up with new and challenging ways for me to go out and see if I can do. And so Bill himself would be idea generating of like, what's a different way I could challenge myself? Like, he'd made up a whole new marathon in Tahoe, a triathlon in Tahoe. He went to Hawaii. He would do things that weren't even like official events, and he would invent them and go out and challenge himself to run 250 miles in Sonoma County. Like, it was all these events that he was curious about how far he could push his body. That really inspired me. And when I, when my path intersected with him in 2019, he was then kind of confronting a race that he wasn't able to succeed at. But that race became, the Arrowhead race had a community of people that kept coming back. Even if they did finish the race, they still wanted to come back because it was always a different type of cold. It was a wet cold or a humid cold or a dry cold or and different levels of cold. And so it was always a slightly different challenge every year. And, you know, I think that within whatever field that you are, if there's a creative variable there, there's a creativity to this athleticism. And I drew a lot of parallels between what interested Bill and what interested me is ultimately the passion and the curiosity that he had to push himself and keep trying even when things are hard, but then to then continue on and do greater things.
Yeah, very interesting. Another thing that I found very curious, since you are and were a new filmmaker at the time, you undertook something that was extremely arduous and just as crazy, in my opinion, as Bill was to undertake the things that he did at his age, because I've watched a lot of things on, you know, the Discovery Channel or the Nat Geo channel, where there have been filmmakers who have filmed in the Arctic or on, you know, all sorts of mountains. And they are filmmakers that have trained for years to film in those kind of conditions. And, you know, it's people who have been adventurers in themselves and who already know how to do those climbs and who have all the equipment and the gear. And I mean, they prep as much as the, you know, as much as the athletes themselves to do those things. But you're a young college student, or at least that age. And I can't, did you have all the equipment? Did you have all of that training? I mean, how the heck did all that happen?
That's a very good question. You know, it comes back to the improv yes and concept, right? It's getting that first invitation, the first opportunity, and saying yes to it, even if you're not like fully prepared. I did go to a more media studies inclined undergraduate school where I did some student filmmaking at UC Santa Barbara. And that was a wonderful, everyone is kind of figuring it out together type of experience. So when I, you know, got the opportunity to start developing Epic Bill, I just bought my very first camera. It was a C100 Mark II with an external recorder to get me a slightly better color profile, you know, color bit depth recording. And I was really like researching and looking at what different types of lenses were. And, you know, so it was really very, very hands-on. And I recently watched our very, very first rough cut to prove that this could become a feature film. And it was a mess. It was a total mess. We were really into like intercutting, but it just kind of snarled up and didn't really make any sense. And was a lot of scenes that were a lot of interviews from a lot of people but it wasn't necessarily focused around Bill's personal story. And you know, it was a very important lesson of sometimes you need to ask for help. Sometimes you need to research on your own. Sometimes you need to fail. So then you could learn that you have to find a new way of doing things. And letting yourself, like giving yourself the allowance to be bad is a huge grace, right? It's a grace because eventually, slower and slower, you're going to more and more quickly realize what is good, what is to your taste. And there's always that taste gap, right? Of like what you like is something that's really, really good, but it's not going to be something that you can immediately do at the first step. It's going to be something that you do have to build your own way towards.
That was a key business principle called fail early, fail often.
Yes. And, you know, but fail sustainably too. I was really lucky in this project because Leslie Murphy she was providing the funding. She really believed in us young filmmakers. She wanted to have us and her sons, Kyle and Sean, along to learn. And I think it's really important to have that sort of mentor figure who believes in you through that process, whether it's in the context of school, whether it's in the context of, you know, being like living at your parents and making it yourself. It's important to recognize that you're in a space where you can do it sustainably and comfortably. And that has a lot to do with like kind of where we are now in the filmmaking industry at large. Is it's getting harder and harder to find that sustainable practice, which is a big, you know, it's a big bummer, and it has real impact on what kind of stories are going to be able to be made here. It's tricky. It's a tricky time.
It is a tricky time. That is absolutely for sure. While we're talking about how difficult it was to kind of film in the elements, what was the hardest scene to capture and why?
That's a good question. There's the emotional answer to that question, and then there's the logistical answer.
Well, I will do logistical. Give me one of both.
Logistically, camera batteries in the cold do not last. It lasted for like maybe 5 minutes in the air. We would tape hand warmers to it to try to keep it going. And when we would go from outside to inside, all the lenses would get condensation and fog up. So we had to figure out our systems of filming in the cold. At one point it was negative 50 degrees with wind chill when we were filming outside. We got out of the car to film a bit, and we would start shivering and shaking and run back in. There was this huge learning curve of just technology and how to work with it. But then there was I think emotionally Bill had his message of, you know, don't quit, never give up, and just keep going at it. But I think it was interesting to try to get at it from, you know, from the why sense of why keep going after it, why keep what happened in your past to start this cycle of, you know, extremity. And there is a sequence that's not in the shorter version of the film. This is the 56-minute version of the film that's distributed. The longer version of the film, we have a sequence where Bill returns to his old video store buildings, and you see him reckon with the past. And, that was a really great sequence where he's realizing he has a line in that sequence where he's talking about how you don't have to look on the past as just focusing on the failures. You can look at the past as focusing on the successes too, because they had a good time. They had a explosively wonderful community. And it is about letting yourself reframe that concept of, you know, letting yourself remember the good times is sometimes hard and sometimes really necessary in order to have the courage to believe that you could have good times again. You could work for having a good time, and that they can happen again. And sometimes that's hard to remember.
It is. I mean, you know, and apparently, I mean, his success in the video industry, it sounded like he was a multimillionaire, and then he lost it all thanks to Netflix, and he was bankrupt. Now, that's interesting to me because I didn't hear him talk about anything that he did professionally after that, other than all of this extreme sports, which he talked about, I think, taking out loan or diving into his 401k. Maybe he invested all of the money that he had, and so he had enough to live on for the rest of his life. And maybe that's what he did. Maybe he financed this whole film. But I am curious about the finances of it, because this is costly. What he was doing is costly. All of the training, all of the travel, all of the years that it took of him doing all of those sports, funding this film could not have been, you know, cheap. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So Bill didn't fund the film. His sister, Leslie, she took over the family business, which is an electrical contractor, W. Bradley Electric, from their father. Bill wanted to start his own business. And so he took out a bunch of credit cards and started the Bradley Video chain with his other sister, Karen. And he did become a multimillionaire. And it was really like a self-starter experience. So, you know, it was literally on credit, on his own 15 credit cards type of deal. And he had immense pride. He felt like a community leader, and they were extremely successful. And then he was on that front line of Netflix coming in, and the video industry, it quit on him. He never quit on it, but it quit on him. And it just completely went bankrupt. As his profits were going down, he was still opening up new buildings, and because he wanted it to succeed so badly. But what's interesting is that Bill didn't come out of that experience. He came out of that experience with, absolutely no money, and he went through a divorce at the same time. So his self-confidence was completely devastated. His identity as a successful businessman was completely erased in such a very public and embarrassing way for him. And there was a lot of people in that community who had a hard time alongside Bill. And he didn't come out of it wanting to be a successful businessman again. He ran that 50 miler, that very first 50 miler that he did on an absolute whim. And he had a little bit of that like Forrest Gump experience where it's like, oh, I just want to keep running. You know, it became a very physical thing for him to build up his self-confidence again through like physical challenges. It wasn't like it wasn't a money thing. So today, even today, he's living in like, you know, a small apartment, and he lives cheaply, and he works with the family company, but he's putting all of his money, his 401k, into doing these events. He's absolutely committed to it. Wow. And so he changed his lifestyle. He changed his priorities. Yeah.
So he's had several, I guess, reinventions, you know, identity changes. Initially his identity was in being this successful businessman that was ripped away from him. And so then his identity becomes this extreme successful athlete. And then it seems like there were things he had to believe about himself, actually, that had to die in order for him to be a little bit more successful. Can you talk a little bit about what needed to die, what things he believed about himself that weren't helping him?
It's a really good question, and it's a bit of a sad answer, because he did have to let go of, he never let go of his belief in himself, but he did have to let go of the concept of he will always be successful in these races, and that failure is an embarrassment, and to hide that, you know, and not to talk about failure. And instead he had to embrace failure. And that was the big change that we discovered while filming with Bill together, and that good things can come out of failure, and that the realization that valuing the courage to try again is a radical concept. It is something that keeps you walking forwards in life. And that was something that he had to let go of and then embrace.
Yeah. And this is the line that he said that I thought was very encouraging to me. Courage is a muscle. Courage is a muscle. And basically what he meant is that we must keep building that muscle. So we must keep challenging ourselves with difficult things. We must, and having courage, I think personally, is not, it's actually moving to do something hard before we believe we can. It is trying and, you know, in spite of the fear that we may fail. I think Leslie, his sister, says the only, and I'm not quoting her specifically correctly, but she says that really the only failure is, you know, failing to do anything, failing to try at all. That if you're, you know, trying, you are succeeding.
Yeah, no, that's actually pretty close to what she says. Yeah, is she, because Leslie was with Bill for his early races. She was his crew chief for the very early marathons. And she, it's really a wonderful thing to be in Bill's presence because he's so positive. It's like he's very, very positive. He dreams up big dreams, not just for himself, but everyone around him. And so when, you know, I was in my early 20s making a film that was like outside of the scope of anything I had ever made, he would, you know, kind of yell at me, Academy Award winning director. And it's hard to not believe in yourself when you have someone who's doing all these great feats, just so happy that you're there and excited to embrace your potential and put forth goals that you don't even have for yourself that he wants to dream up for you because he's so excited to see passion in anybody. And that, you know, yeah. Leslie saw that. She was right there on the front lines with him, and she saw him keeping on going and being like, this is a story that's worthy of telling. And it kind of goes back to my concept of like having a mentor and having that invitation into filmmaking is being around people who can see that in you, in your work ethic, and can see that, can help you achieve that. So yeah, I mean, if I could describe filmmaking, I would describe it as one long conversation with yourself and many conversations with other people.
That's a great way to put it. I've experienced that in my own life. I started off as an actress, and there's been definite invitations into filmmaking as well, where people deeper into the industry who've been there longer than I had just extended a hand. Can you help me do this? I think you can do this. So particularly with my own film, The Girl Who Wore Freedom, people believed in me far more than I did. Everyone did. People still do believe in me far more than I do. And I do think it's important to surround yourself with people like that and also be incredibly grateful for them. And then be those people for others as you start out in the industry. One thing that I found interesting as you talk about Bill's sister, I found her fascinating because on the one hand, it's very interesting to hear that she supported the film because you see her sort of being supportive in the beginning and thinking that it's really cool. But there's also part of her that seems like she thinks he's a little over the top and a little crazy. And okay, this is too much. I think he's risking his life and I don't like this so much. Am I reading her right?
Yeah, that is the other side of it too. And I do want to speak a little towards something that I was noticing, something that I learned over the course of making this film is who you are talking to, who you are interviewing, and what they should speak on in the context of the film, right? And Leslie is this amazing, almost voice of reason in contrast to Bill's huge goals. And there's this wonderful scene where we're in Bill's apartment with Leslie and Bill's pointing out all of his big goals for 2030 that he wants to do. And, you know, it's like biking to South America and it's all of these really
all the pictures on his wall, right?
The Bill Wall of Dreams, which is very famous in my mind. And it's a great wall to have for anyone to have, you know, just put up something to visualize. That's part of Bill's process, is visualize, look. It is a bit of like brainwashing, as he calls it, himself into positivity, into believing into these big dreams, because you do have to say something in order to work towards it. You have to say something to believe in it. And that's, you know, really a big part of his process, is that kind of visualization. And Leslie's there and you just see her face like, what? No, like, no, don't do that. Oh, just rein it in just a bit, Bill, you know?
She's like, these are the things that you want to do. And he's like, oh no, these are the things I am doing.
Will do. I will do them. And that's something important to pay attention to in yourself too, is are you using, you know, active tense? Are you going to commit yourself to it? Or are you still talking in the maybes and, you know, someday? And that's a little trick too, that you can change with how you speak about your own dreams. So Leslie was a wonderful character because she was the stakes, right? Like, Bill, you know, I talked with Bill about, you know, kind of the cost of these events. It's a cost of health. It's a cost of danger. It's a cost of risk. But who is going to carry that cost? Who's going to be most affected? It's going to be Bill's loved ones. If something tragic happens out there, it's going to be Leslie who really, really suffers that cost, and everyone who knows and loves Bill. And that is a sad thing. And that's something important to portray. And, you know, when you talk about mentors, I can also talk about models in filmmaking. So a big model for me was the film Free Solo. I hadn't gone to USC yet when I was making this film. And in post, I was really trying to figure out how to make it compelling, what scenes to use, who should be speaking about what part of Bill's really long and complex history of all these different races and the business and different like arenas and, you know, all these different things that he did, how to tie that all together. And it was really looking at the psychology of Bill and at who had the most emotion, who had the most intense perspective of any particular subject that I was talking about with any particular scene. And Leslie was, you know, in Free Solo, it was Alex Honnold's girlfriend at the time, Sunny. She's the one who would carry the cost. She's the one who's wondering, should I commit to someone who's then just so committed to my passion, which is dangerous, you know? And can I let myself be a part of that? And, you know, that was, Leslie was the right one to speak on that.
Yeah, pretty amazing. I love how you bring your psychology degree to your filmmaking. I can see it. Yeah, all right, I want to move into it is actually. So is acting, you know. I mean, I think that's a psychology degree is incredibly useful in our industry, for sure. Okay, I want to move into our last little section here. I'm calling it the filmmaker's reality, and we're going to talk about distribution and the money. And I want to talk about your actual path, because people are going to be really interested in that. It's changing all the time, and it'll have even changed from the time that you started this process. But let's talk about, you started off with PBS. And so I want to know how PBS changed the film's credibility, and what did it not solve?
Yeah, that's a good question. So we got into PBS through the NITA, application, which is really, really wonderful. It's like, you know, the National Education of Television, or like Telecommunications Association, something like that.
I wonder if that even still exists.
Yeah. So yeah, what's really, really heartbreaking about what's happening now is that, you know, hopefully you have funding and distribution opportunities for films. And the more that shrinks, the more disheartening it is, because we made this film with Leslie and Red Rap Productions. And this was, you know, the first film to be made with a production company who was started for this project. But we didn't have connections. We didn't make it through a fellowship or a mentorship. We didn't have a brand. I wasn't an established director. So we had no like huge like branding or name
credibility necessarily.
Yeah. And I learned that credibility is a huge part of documentary distribution. If we had like Bill has had success and, you know, he has followings on YouTube and Instagram, but not necessarily, he's not necessarily like a household name. And so that was something that I had to learn is, you know, fame can go a long way and open doors. And when you don't have that, it's tough. So PBS was a really wonderful way to send our film out. And whenever we would send it out and we would screen it to family and friends, people really resonated with the, you know, never giving up, the messages of the film, the reinvention, the passion, the scene, the landscapes, the, you know, the races, the excitement of it. And found it really inspiring. And that, you know, that was the most gratifying, was hearing directly from audiences, like who watched the film, like how much they loved it. And we had a lot of wonderful reviews. But distribution is an art. It's an art that I'm still figuring out. So we went to PBS. It did not solve the, great, we're successful and have a bunch of money off this film. No, not at all. but it, you know, it did at least give credibility of, look, this film can make it onto PBS. This is a distributable film. And so when we approached BitMax, who got us onto Apple TV and Amazon, that was a great way of saying it's gone to PBS. And that's, you know, that's important.
Yeah. Can you tell us who BitMax is? I've never heard of them.
So there's different kinds of kind of intermediaries between a distributor like Apple TV and the filmmaker, and BitMax kind of does the quality checks and can basically is like, you know, they kind of help with distribution by kind of validating the film and saying the film is up to technical specs. The film is, the rating is, you know, good for us. And they kind of walk you through then getting in touch with Apple TV and Amazon. So there's people that will, there's companies that will help with being kind of brokers for that process.
Do you pay them or do they get a percentage? Is it like a typical distributor?
They're more of an intermediary. So we pay them for the quality check process. And then I don't believe they get a it depends on the different deals, but I don't believe they have a percentage of the distribution. That is split between Apple TV and Amazon. When someone buys it off of their platforms, the Apple TV or Amazon gets half of it and we would get the other half. But I think
right.
BitMax
and do they
is
pay
more
you
like
directly, or do they pay BitMax?
They pay us directly.
Interesting. Are you able to get any stats or anything like that from Amazon or Apple TV?
Yeah. You have like a kind of whenever someone purchases the film. It does like log it. So we have like an account and then it kind of says like, hey, you know, 15 people have gotten your film. You've made $5 or less. Hmm.
And are you able to, I know that my distributor, Virgil Films, ding, 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 a proud sponsor of our podcast. We thank them very much. Virgil Films is able to pitch our film for advertising, you know, specials that they have, whether it's Veterans Day or, you know, they don't do D-Day, they do Veterans Day or they do 4th of July. And they'll have like, you know, specials during that time. Do you pitch your film the same way?
To like other distributors or to like,
Like on Amazon and Apple. Amazon and Apple TV don't really let you advertise. The only way they let you advertise is they will let you pitch them for their advertising, like promotions. And so they have advertising promotions for each holiday, Mother's Day, Father's Day, mm-hmm. Veterans Day. You'll see them when you turn on, you know, Amazon. And distributors are allowed to pitch them for their films.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I wasn't hugely a part of that conversation, but I think we would have had to pay for more advertising through their platforms. But I'm not totally sure. I think that we definitely have had a pitch packet go out and, you know, materials and upload, you know, all the kind of press stuff. But I think you should look into that.
Yeah, I think you should look into that because I think that if your film is, you know, if your film, let's say it's about mothers and you think it would be a good fit for Mother's Day, you are able to, I think, and I'll have Virgil Films back on to talk about this. I think that you are able to make a pitch to Amazon for, let's say, to have your film included in their Mother's Day promotion packet. So it would run for 99 cents, let's say, and the hope would be that your film would, a bunch of people would watch your film for 99 cents and you would want them to, so that they would tell their friends, hey, you should watch this film. It's on special right now, sort of to get the ball rolling for your film. And that's the point of including your film. And I don't think it costs you anything when you do that. But anyway, look into that. Okay, next question I have for you is, what deliverables surprised you the most? Closed caption, QC art specs, you know, music cues, etc. Anything surprise you?
We worked with really wonderful like finishing. So we had a really, really wonderful collaboration with Laura Cartman and Nora Kroll Rosenbaum as the composers. They gave us all the stems and Laura went away to work on a Marvel TV show. And so I was kind of music editing while editing for this film. And so I had stems. I had an idea of like, okay, we're going to have different exports. I did short films before, so I knew, you know, the process of going, making a DCP. Deliverables for, you know, PBS and Bitmax, like PBS was really specific on the time cut. So the reason why Epic Bill became 56 minutes is it was originally 93 and then it was 86 and PBS wanted 56 because that would be the most programmed slot that we could share the film out to as much as we could. So we actually had to cut down the film and we have like four different versions of it. But the 56 minute version is like, you know, it was painful to cut and leave darlings on the cutting room floor, but it was, you know, the tightest and most snappy version of the film. And that was interesting. That process was really interesting to me. I finished the 93 minute version before I went to USC to get my master's in film. And I cut it down to 56 minutes in my first year of being at USC. And I was learning so much about storytelling. And I was like, oh, this is, you know, this, I can see how quickly I'm growing as a storyteller by doing this process. So we cut the film down to deliver it to PBS's standards. And then we then, of course, had the different exports that Luke Cahill gave for our different sound stems, the different, you know, dialogue track versus the sound design versus the, you know, backgrounds and the music, of course. And then we had different, you know, different like interlace for television. It was just different formats of the film. So it was a lot of technical stuff that we learned and went through. But yeah, it was definitely the cutting it down to fit a TV format was what was the biggest hurdle.
I found that same thing to be true. We had an entree to PBS ourselves. They wanted us to cut down our film the same way. There was just no way. We felt like we could do it with the keeping the integrity of the film, so we didn't do it. Yeah, I don't know if that was a mistake, but we had to pass. All right, question. How did you learn about promotion from CNN and Sirius XM? And can other filmmakers take advantage of that? And then did you feel like that was helpful or worth it?
So we had a wonderful marketing head called Pat Simmons. He did a wonderful job outreaching. He did a lot of cold emails. We also worked with New Heights as a marketing team, and they did a lot of cold emails. So I wasn't directly in touch with setting that up, but it literally is, you know, creating a press kit, creating a one pager, selling the film. You make the film many, many times, and distribution is another way of making your film and presenting your film and pitching your film. And Bill had done interviews with people before, and it was about creating a whole spreadsheet of contacts and who you want to send it out to and sending the film out to journalists. So I'm not totally sure how we landed the CNN and SiriusXM. I was in the middle of doing my USC degree at the time. But I do know that it takes a lot of really good emails and a good pitch packet, gathering quotes from people who have seen the film, and honestly doing research of how other people have presented their film, have marketed their film. It's a grind, and it sucks. It totally sucks.
Yeah, it is a grind.
As a filmmaker, you want to move on to your next project, right? And the reality is that, you know, the project to survive and be seen, you have to keep putting it out there yourself. So if you can find a creative way to be excited about that process, great. But, you know, it is part of it. It is part of it.
Yep. I am still doing it today in 2026 with my film, which came out in 2022. And so endurance is the motto. Endurance is the motto. Okay. So, we talked about a lot of things in this episode. I want you to think, I'm going to give you a stress test. This is what I'm calling sort of a new little segment at the end. The industry stress test. Industry stress test. Pretend that you are finishing a doc now in 2026. Nobody's buying it outright. So you're taking it to Netflix or Amazon or Apple TV, and everybody's rejecting you. What is your plan A, B, and C? What do you do next? Three things.
Ooh, good question. Well, I've been there. Face rejection, just like Bill. I would say that you have a list, you keep applying, you keep looking at who is your audience, right? Who wants to see the film? You keep screening it. So we're going to screen Epic Bill at USC on January 28th, for example. And you definitely, like, I would kind of go down my list on who would be interested. Like, there's different paths of distribution out there. There's, you know, everyone is like, oh no, there's YouTube and you could just release on YouTube. But if you're making a film, the point is to have people watch it, right? And there's an ego check of where it's being screened, but, you know, hopefully ultimately, And sustainably is the other concept, is if it's a money question of you want to have your film make a lot of money, that's one thing. But then there's also the how many people do you want to see your film, and what platform can you put it on to be seen in the most ways? Like PBS, it was screened across the nation, and it was one of the top performing films out there a lot of times for PBS. So we had tremendous success of getting it out there and getting it seen. And that was really, really wonderful to hear and have people excited about. And that was important to me, right? It was in a place that people would watch it. And I think that at the end of the day, it's about what your priorities are. Is it a money thing? Are people looking at it? And I think that, you know, I've had a lot of short films that I sealed up away onto my private Vimeo link and have not seen the light of day because I was just waiting for them to come out and be accepted by film festivals and then be screened. But then I would go to the film festivals and it would be a wonderful screening. And, but sometimes it'd be a very small audience. And I would be like, you know, maybe it's not the right thing to just hold on to a film for a year or two or three, just hoping it gets chosen by somebody else. How can you approach this in an empowering way? And that is being clear on what you want out of the process. And that that is about, you know, choosing how you can, what your priorities are. So the best way to reframe kind of getting rejected is saying, okay, this project is not right for this distributor, but how is it right for what I want and how can I get there?
Perfect. Great answers. Great answers. Okay. Two more questions. One uncomfortable truth, one practical tool. All right. The uncomfortable truth. What do filmmakers need to stop believing about distribution?
Distribution does not solve or make your career by itself. You do that. You figure out your process. You stick to it. You find joy and curiosity that makes you keep creating. And the trick is how to keep going. It's not the finish. This film, Epic Bill, does not end at the finish line. If you watch to the end, the film ends with the starting line. And that is a key part of how I made this film, is figuring out that you just start again. So figure out that.
Totally love that. Great answer. And practical tool. What is one spreadsheet, document, template, or online tool that you would encourage every filmmaker to have?
I used something called Snapple, which is a little software where I could, you know, it kind of does a visualization digital board, like cork board a little bit, to group my ideas around in little boxes. So Snapple's a good one. But there's this exercise I do that I did with Free Solo, that I did with any films that I enjoy that are similar to the project I'm doing next. And I sit down and I watch that film and I go scene by scene. I write down what each scene accomplishes, who's speaking in it, how it arrows into the next scene, how the character is what they're choosing, what they're faced with. And I really break it down scene by scene. And that just gets me into the rhythm of what a feature film feels like and the pace of it and how it's all working together. And it's a cheat, you know, you're looking at what someone has arrived to, their conclusion of a film, what works for a film. So go out there and see what works and learn. And that's how I did it. You know, just go out and observe.
That's a great study tool. And I think that's particularly useful because films change every year. And so, you know, as a voiceover actor, a coach told me one time, go and listen to the commercials that are out right now. And that will tell you what ad agencies are using and buying, and then train yourself to do that sound or whatever sound that is that's in your range. And that will make you more marketable or more sellable to, you know, the buyers. It's true, I think, with films, when you're watching those, if you're studying what is out right now, what distributors are buying, like you said, the pace, or look at what films are on the market. Of course, we know the most sellable are horror or, you know, crime dramas or things like that. But there are other things out there. There are a lot of, you know, things like you're talking about, this, you know, that you've done. There's a lot of epic journey stories out there, endurance sport things out there as well. So I think that is, those are really good suggestions to watch that and emulate that. Great. Great, great stuff. Great, great stuff. Thank you so much for all of your advice, sharing your experiences. And now we are going to move into everybody's favorite section so that you can share some more ideas with us. We are now going to move into DocuView Deja Vu. All right, here we are, and you are going to share not one, but I hear three favorite documentaries with us.
Yes. So in light of Epic Bill, I definitely, of course, have to say Free Solo. The other one that I studied was Maru by Jimmy Chin and Elizabeth Vassarati. It was really, really similar in structure and kind of, you know, showed me the path that they made into making a more ambitious film with Free Solo. And then the last one is just a personal favorite of mine. It's Crip Camp. I really loved. I was crying during it, and it's, you know, largely about just the heart of community, in my opinion. And definitely Crip Camp. I would definitely recommend giving that a watch.
Yeah, Crip Camp was at the Sundance Film Festival the year I went, I think 2019. And it's a really good one, about people that are, what is the right word?
Folks with various physical disabilities.
There you go.
It's about the disability revolution and just the beginnings of that kind of stuff. And it's great. Watch it.
Yeah. Very touching and heartwarming. Okay. How can people get a hold of you, or where can they follow you? Tell us a little bit about what we can do to learn more.
Yeah. There's a Epic Bill, the film website. You can Google it, Epic Bill Film, and you'll find it. We have an Instagram and Epic Bill Film. And we also, you could find me at Quinlan.com is my website. And my Instagram handle is at Quinlan, Quinnolyn. You'll find
Excellent.
Me there.
All right. And we're going to put all that in our show notes as well. We really appreciate you being here. Before I go, everybody, I just want to remind you that we too have social media on Instagram, TikTok, Facebook, and Twitter. Well, I guess we have to call it X now, although I don't like that. I still think of it as Twitter. We are on all of those social medias. We've been sort of hanging back, not posting a lot, but we are going to start sharing more little snippets of our podcast guests on our platform. So make sure to follow those. We have some really interesting guests coming up this year, and we are going to start a Substack. I'm going to start writing and sharing some things I'm learning about the industry. So take a look on Substack, or keep watching our social media. We'll put more out about that. And if you'd like to support us, follow us on Patreon, patreon.com/documentaryfirst. We really would love to have your support. We'd love for you to be part of our community. One of the things that we've talked about in this episode is actually, a lot about that. I want to just reiterate sort of our three takeaways. Reinvention is a system. Show up and just, suffer, iterate, endure, and then don't let distribution be your identity. Don't let any one thing be your identity. Build purpose and have a process. Three, packaging, audience, and endurance are the new modes. You need to make sure that you are packaged, beautifully for your product, that you know who your audience is, and never give up. So those are the three points for our little podcast today that you filmmakers need to take away and remember. Hope you've learned a lot from Quinlan today. I know that I have. Thank you so much for joining us here on Documentary First, where we believe everybody has a story to tell, and you can be the one to tell it. Bye, everybody.
Thank you so much for having me.
Hey, everybody. This podcast is brought to you by Documentary First Productions, and we need your support so that we can keep preserving history. If you could go over and grab some merch or watch our films at documentaryfirst.com, you'll help us keep making awesome documentaries and sharing the stories that matter, and also bring amazing filmmakers and their wonderful films to the world. So thank you so much for listening, and thank you for visiting documentaryfirst.com.
Thank you for listening to Documentary First. We really appreciate your partnership with us. We can't do any of this without you. So thank you for listening, donating, and following along on our journey. We are supported by generous donations from people just like you. To make a donation, visit thegirlwhowarefreedom.com or support us on Patreon at patreon.com/documentaryfirst. To learn more about our other works in progress, visit documentaryfirst.com or follow Documentary First on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and LinkedIn. This podcast was produced by Documentary First, edited and mixed by Jason Hoban, with music by Jeff Kurtenacker.